I went to very far away, very almost unreachable communities, and which are on the fringes of the contact with the modern world. And I would think, you know, if I tried to bring these people in to work on a film and pay them with the best intentions, I could end up destroying them, because it brings into a society a lot of things, you know, greed, it brings envy, it brings, and these are people who don't really need that. We have a very simple way of life.
Director of the Oscar-nominated Amazonian set Mystical Wonder, Embrace of the Serpent. More from him shortly. From Midori House in London, you're tuned to The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Coming up.
In France, Too Late for Tears is known as Les Tigres.
The bizarre story of an almost forgotten film's journey to restoration and newfound status as a classic. Then we're off to Beirut.
Prior to the start of the civil war in the mid-70s, Lebanon's film industry was rivaling regional powerhouse Egypt in output.
Plus, continuing last week's Italian theme, we'll head to Naples with the writer of Gomorrah, Roberto Saviano. That's all to come on The Cinema Show, your culture guide to the world of film on Monocle 24. Hello from London, I'm Ben Ryland. Our French and Italian expedition has finally come to an end, but we'll bring you one more highlight a little later when Roberto Saviano recalls his mafia-shattering book's journey from paper to film and then television. But first, Embrace of the Serpent is the third film from director Ciro Guerra. It takes us deep into the Amazon alongside two men from the Western world on two parallel stories decades apart. Shot in luscious black and white and filled with stunning images of rushing waters and endless jungle terrain, it played as part of the director's fortnight in Cannes and picked up an Oscar nomination for Best Foreign Language Film earlier this year. Director Ciro Guerra joins me now in the studio. Ciro, thanks so much for being here. The film is inspired by the travel journals of Theodor Kosch-Grünberg and Richard Evans Schultz. Tell me about how and why those texts came to your attention.
Making a film in the Amazon has been a lifelong dream of mine. So I just started doing some research. I had done two previous films that were very personal, and I just wanted to get away from that. I wanted to take a journey into the unknown and sort of invite the viewer into this journey. I started reading about the Amazon because I always been interested and I didn't know anything about it. You know, it's a side of our country that is completely neglected. It's a place that is so remote.
It's interesting to me that the basis for how you got on to this story came from the travel journals of these two people that the characters that are seen in the film, because there's this other realm of thinking that's portrayed in the film. Karamakate, he does not seem to be very on board with this concept of recording information. He finds it quite amusing that one of the characters records drawings and writings inside his book, and the concept of a photograph is also something that just doesn't resonate with them or his people at all, is it?
Yes, it's a very interesting way of conceiving knowledge. The time that I spent there, I learned that it's not that indigenous people are not able to write their knowledge, you know, or it's just that they don't believe in it. To them, knowledge needs to be alive in the tongue of the person expressing it and in the mind of the person receiving it. And if you write it down, if you record it somehow, it dies. It sort of stagnates, you know, it becomes dogma. It becomes something that is still, and nothing is still in life for them. And essentially, we are the product of all the stories that have been told to us. And everything that we take for granted is just an opinion. It's just a way of understanding. But the idea of truth, the idea of fact, is something that is very questionable.
Now, I would have to say that this is a testing film. It's emotionally testing. It's morally testing as well. There are actually two sequences involving possessions, and I think there's a bit of a commentary here on consumerism. Two men wandering through the jungle, carrying probably far more luggage than you'd fit in the average carry-on bag, and Karamakate, the tribal guide for the two men, he thinks the possessions are ridiculous and that they're symptoms of a culture that consumes everything at once until there is nothing left. Is that how you view Western culture?
the process of being in the Amazon, of spending time with them and learning from them, is a really big process of confrontation. And I am a part of Western culture, you know, so that's the culture in which I grew up in. But to see this confrontation, every day you are asked questions that make you question yourself and the way you live. For example, I was fascinated by the myth, a myth that is in the film, the myth of the Shujachaki, you know, this myth that we all have a double wandering around the world, you know, but it's like a hollow copy of ourselves that is wandering around the world by itself, trying to deceive other people. How does that communicate to a time in which people are communicating through virtual avatars, you know? How these extremes of humanity come together and dialogue. And I think, yeah, it's not about saying something is better than the other, but it's about how we can also actually learn from peoples that we have forever neglected or seen as underdeveloped and poor and in many ways subhuman creatures, you know, how their way of life gives us something that we can actually learn from.
There's almost a rejection of the concept of economics in the film, though, as well, isn't there? I mean, there's a moment where the American character hands two American banknotes to Karamakaze. It feels like a ridiculous moment anyway. I mean, handing someone in the jungle some money, of what's he going to do with it? You know, he's in the middle of the Amazon. But that does seem to indicate some sort of rejection of what we would call capitalism and the actual line about white men consuming everything until there is nothing left. That comes from Karamakaze, and he's a firm believer in the economics of the jungle. And really, that is his version of economics. You have to treat the resources that the jungle gives you with respect, otherwise they will all disappear and everything will die. Do you feel that that was some sort of subtle rejection of how obsessed with consumerism the modern world can become and has been for many, many years?
Yes, I was in places where, you know, where you could bring $1 million and the best thing that you could do with it was to make a bonfire out of it. And I was in places where really people don't have money and don't use money because, you know, and it's dangerous to bring money. I saw it firsthand, you know, how I went to very far away, very almost unreachable communities and which are on the fringes of the contact with the modern world. And I would think, you know, if I tried to bring these people in to work on a film and pay them with the best intentions, I could end up destroying them because it brings into a society a lot of things, you know, greed, it brings envy, it brings, and these are people who don't really need that. We have a very simple way of life. And it was just great for me to know that you can still exist. There are it's a great feeling to know that there are places where you can live without money, you know, wherever you arrive, there will always be a plate of food and a smile for you, you know, regardless of who you are. So I decided to sort of go back and work with people who are in contact with the modern world. So the people that you see in the film, they are portraying their past, their ancestors, the stories of their ancestors, but they are also people who have one foot in the modern world and one foot in the traditional world. But, you know, they have cell phones and they have soccer t-shirts and they have been paid and they have the concept of working for and it's good that you can help them in when they are brought on a project like this. They are very happy to participate because you can actually help them improve their way of life. But yes, you have to be very careful about that. And definitely it's a place in which the rules that we live by tend to appear ridiculous. And the indigenous people usually find it very funny and they are usually laughing at you all the time.
Ciro Guerra, director of the Oscar-nominated Embrace of the Serpent, out in UK theatres today. We were in Cannes just a few weeks ago, and Venice is coming up soon too. On the International Film Festival circuit, however, Beirut isn't exactly a city you'd often hear mentioned. But every year, one of Beirut's most famous landmarks, the St. Nicholas Stairs, are transformed into an outdoor cinema for a pint-sized film festival over a weekend. And it's more than just a celebration of film. The participants say the festival provides a platform to discuss issues that can be hard to raise in a country as delicately balanced as Lebanon. Ed Woodhouse went to find out more.
Prior to the start of the civil war in the mid-70s, Lebanon's film industry was rivaling regional powerhouse Egypt in output. Shoring up all corners of the market, movies with lascivious titles like The Pussies of Hammer Street were released alongside quaintly bucolic musical productions, starring iconic Lebanese singer Fairuz. But inevitably, as bullets started flying, production slowed. And while there have been some notable exceptions, in truth, the industry here has never fully recovered. But while widespread commercial success might now be a more remote possibility, film that aims to achieve artistically and make a point about Lebanese society is thriving.
We want to promote those short films that they had really, really a huge impact and a huge subject that they can impact all the world. From that idea, we had this idea to promote that for the big public. So we created the festival. It was an idea for one night. And then we said one night it's really little. Let's make it a weekend. And it's Friday, Saturdays and Sunday every year.
That's Brahim Samaha, founder of the Cabriolet Film Festival and known to all as Bob. Cabriolet is just one of a number of independent film festivals in Lebanon, but it is surely the prettiest. Every year, Bob and his colleagues transform a huge picturesque staircase in the center of the city into an outdoor cinema and show a program of shorts, including a carefully curated clutch of locally produced movies.
The location, it's St. Nicholas Stairs in the heart of Beirut. And we promote public space because we don't have public space in Lebanon. So it's a part of the festival that we promote those public spaces and to interact with those spaces together. And we create every year a theme. So based on that theme, we can watch, like this year, 16 point of views from different countries on the same subject. And this is a treasure for us to watch really many point of views in the same subject.
And what's this year's subject?
Conflict.
And why do you think that's important in Lebanon to talk about?
Last year it was women. Before that it was change. Before that it was beyond borders. Next year it will be refugees. So we choose the theme based on what's happening all over the world. And the second year we promote that. The screening began, so...
Allo?
Scotty?
La. Sorry, I'm the one who's calling you.
Where are you calling from?
Lebanon.
بس كان بدي كان بدي حدا يسمع.
كان بدي أقول على حدا. ودقيت لك وقلت بركة بتسمعني.
There's nothing wrong when you listen to me.
بس
you are not sick and you are not wrong and God does not hate you.
I love making movies. I love making independent short movies, talking about some themes that are, for me, like frustrating a bit, that I need to talk about it because I just want to express myself.
This is filmmaker Carl Haddad, and before him was a clip from his beautiful award-winning film, My Name Is, which was set to be one of the big screenings of this year's festival.
So we chose the topic of the movie about Harvey Milk. We are talking about a guy who wants to come out to his mom and he doesn't know what to do. And he remembers what Harvey Milk said. The sentence was, "I am Harvey Milk and I'm here to recruit you." So he used like this sentence in his head to have this power and this inspiration to go and talk to his mom about it. That's the movie.
Except, after receiving plaudits, Carl and his crew didn't get to screen My Name Is at the festival. Despite Cabriolet's best efforts to defend the film, they ultimately had to bow to a decision handed down by Lebanon's intelligence agency, the Orwellianly named General Security.
We were supposed to be screening in Cabriolet Film Festival, but the General Security of Lebanon banned the screening of the movie because they said that we were making like a propaganda for homosexuality and this was not right and this is illegal. Even though we don't have like sexual stuff in the movie, we don't have, like sex scenes, we don't have this. We are talking about a guy who wants to come out to his mom and he doesn't know what to do.
Despite the disappointment of not getting shown this year, Carl remains convinced that festivals screening movies like his are vital in Lebanon.
I believe that movies are a way to start a revolution because when people watch the movie, they are just getting so much information and they are trying and they will try to understand the character and what is the character doing, you know, to share his feeling. And this is nice. This is good because usually people, when they watch a gay-themed movie, that there's no sex scenes in it, they accept it in a way or another. They just watch. Also, we have to mention that this festival is taking part in Beirut, and Beirut needs these kind of festivals. Beirut needs to rise again, you know, because we need to feel like there's a new life, there's a new blood in Beirut.
Another film with potentially inflammatory subject matter did get shown, Michel Zarazir's riotously funny Under the Robes, which closed this year's festival. I spoke to Michel afterwards as the event was broken down around us for another year.
It's about a convent of nuns. The Monsignor came to announce to them that he will sold the land, and during his visit he steps on a landmine. And the panic sets and the face is questionable here.
Of course, Lebanon is a place with a delicate religious balance. So, was he worried about offending people?
I think every art has an influence on something, and the cinema and this festival, they have. Because when we watch now the film, many people now, they were laughing at the film, but in fact, they learned something about nuns and about religious people. We have a fear to talk about religion, and this is not good. We should talk about faith, about religious people, about religion, but maybe in a horror movie, maybe in a comedy movie, maybe in a drama movie, but softly and in a good way.
Cabriolet's organizers are entirely committed to getting ideas like Michel's out there, to flying the flag and letting people see what contemporary Lebanese cinema has to say. In fact, thanks to the festival's dogged partnership building, all the Lebanese films on the festival this year will be screened in a further 22 festivals around the world. So, while the industry here may be financially quieter than it once was, it is still very much endeavouring to make itself heard. For Monocle, in Beirut, I'm Edward House.
Now, you might recall a few weeks ago we spoke to Eddie Miller from the Film Noir Foundation. One of the films we mentioned is a personal favourite of mine, a film that's been making a bit of a subtle comeback in recent years after wallowing away in public domain limbo for decades. Too Late for Tears was the first film noir I ever saw. I first came across the movie via a noir box set filled with out-of-copyright obscurities that I dug out of a bargain basement bin in a country town somewhere in Australia. By today's standards, that sketchy, crackly version that I watched and is often found online is almost unwatchable. So it's a welcome delight that, from Monday, a pristine, newly restored version will finally make its way to Blu-ray here in the UK and in some other territories too. Here's the Film Noir Foundation's Eddie Muller again, recalling the journey of Too Late for Tears from cinema obscurity to reappraised classic.
It is pretty amazing, and it's just an example of one of those films that can just disappear. I mean, we could talk for hours about how that happens and how independently made films of that era did not have the protection of a big studio if they were not, you know, owned by the studio, which was the case with this film. And so for years, despite, you know, having such a great and witty and fun screenplay and great performances by these magnetic stars, Liz Scott and Dan Duryea is also tremendous in this film, it just slid away into obscurity. And the only way you could see it was exactly as you describe, on these really terrible public domain copies. But my Film Noir Foundation, which was created precisely for this type of thing, spent a number of years trying to track down surviving what we call elements of this film to see if there's any way we could restore it in pristine condition. And I gotta tell you, it was a challenge, and it took many, many years and a lot of money and a lot of perseverance to bring this film back.
Listen to me, Alan. I love you, darling. And if you decide we should never touch the money, we won't. But do we have to make up our minds now? Can't we just hide it someplace where it can't be traced to us and give ourselves time to think it out? Please help me hide it. I'll leave the rest to you. If you don't think we should ever touch it, we won't.
Someone had sold a nitrate print of the film to a person, and that alone was, that's illegal. because your nitrate is so flammable that like commercial exchange of nitrate film in the States is really not a good thing. It's actually against the law. But somebody gave me a tip about this, and they wouldn't give me the fellow's name, but I was at, it was just like a detective story. I was given clues because they didn't want to violate the terms of the sale, because the guy said, don't release my name because then people will find out that I have a lot of nitrate film stored improperly. Up until the phone call that was not answered, and then I learned from the people running the theater that this guy had died, because I knew that he died with a storage unit filled with nitrate films, but I was never able to locate it. Eventually, we were able to find elements in France. So in France, Too Late for Tears is known as Le Tigres, the Tigress. And only by knowing that were we able to see on a list of things that was being shipped to the UCLA Film and Television Archive, there was something that was just called Le Tigres. And I said, oh, I bet you I know what that is.
I like that trick with your eyes, too. Oh, I'm just taking my cue like a little gentleman.
You're taking it a little too fast.
Isn't that what you wanted?
Did you notice where the liquor was when you went through my kitchen?
Sure.
Go make us a drink.
Stalling, honey?
What do I call you besides stupid?
Stupid will do if you don't bruise easily. Otherwise, you might try Danny.
As sexy as Lauren Bacall could be, she never played a femme fatale in the movies. Not once. In all those films with Bogart, she's always the good girl. She's like the one there to save the hero, not to lead him on the road to ruin. And Liz Scott was a far more ambiguous figure. Sometimes she was just like the girlfriend if the part wasn't particularly well written. But when she got a bad girl part, she could make the most of it. Now, here's something I want to tell you that's kind of surprising, is that she didn't like doing that. Because I have had Elizabeth Scott several times to my film festivals in Hollywood, and she, when I said it, we're really trying to find Too Late for Tears and we want to make a big deal out of this, she didn't like playing that part. And she didn't really like the movie, which really surprised me, because I think she preferred to play good girls in the films. She said, oh, I didn't like that movie at all. You know, I'm so bad in it. And it's like, well, yeah, that's why it's so great.
Eddie Meller from the Film Noir Foundation discussing the 1949 film noir classic Too Late for Tears and its brilliantly vicious star, Elizabeth Scott. Too Late for Tears is out on Blu-ray this Monday, restored by the UCLA Film and Television Archive. They've also applied their magic to the wonderful 1950 noir Woman on the Run, which, like Too Late for Tears, also features a woman as its lead protagonist, a somewhat unusual trait in the classic noir era. Both are available from Arrow Films. Up next, we'll head to the Gulf of Naples. Stay tuned.
Do you like good films? Well, you're in luck. The Cinema Show is presented in association with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic, and award-winning cinema. And we've got a special treat happening at the moment. Just for our loyal listeners, a whole month of movies for free. Head over to MUBI.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. Because life is too short for bad films.
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24 with me, Ben Rylan. Aside from being a gritty masterpiece of a city, Naples also harbours a somewhat less fortunate reputation as a hub for mafia activity. The 2008 film Gomorra caused ripples of outrage upon its release. Despite making it all the way to Cannes, Roberto Saviano now lives amid high security, his life constantly under threat. He spoke to Monocle contributor Mari Giusti.
Noi portiamo la bibliografia, perché questo è successo davvero. Il fatto che sia successo davvero.
The film adaptation process was facilitated by the nature of my narrative style. The method of non-fiction novel especially favours a series. One of the most interesting things of this age is that television series attract a lot of audience because, finally, they go deep into a story. In a film that is 120 minutes, for instance about mafia, even if you look at the masterpiece of The Godfather, also a great book, the character of the Neapolitan descent shows a lot about power struggles, how money is made, but in the film there was no space for it. You understand a little bit about extortion, prostitutes, you get it. Gambling, everything is mentioned, but you never see how Don Vito establishes his power. You don't understand. You see that they mention a politician here and there, but you don't see the mechanisms of power. You see their elegance. You see the way they kill. You are just shown the most objective and spectacular sides of the story. The TV series has more time. It gives you time. This is why House of Cards, Breaking Bad, and Gomorrah, they have the opportunity to explain certain dynamics that film cannot convey, and journalism fails to be so engaging. For the very flexibility of my style, the passage to fiction has not been so hard, because the series is inspired by the characters, but does not have the imposition of philological accuracy. Often, even the level of corruption is much greater in reality, so great that we fear that by portraying it realistically, we will not be believed. Reality overcomes fiction. Real life is crazier than fiction, by far crazier. The thing that in general is changed in TV series is that in series, you see more gunshots. Generally two or three gunshots are fired to kill, not more, but on TV, you use the whole magazine. It's useful to give the homicide the right weight. Because it was only bang bang, you wouldn't even notice. Sometimes we did that. When Donna Emma dies, only two gunshots are used. In the street, that was the most important murder of the first season, relegated to a very short image, and marginal, because homicides are like this.
Però, per esempio, il cinema americano.
But, for instance, cinema, American cinema, narrates the employment of guns in a completely wrong way. The guns are held weirdly, they are burning. They don't know where to put them after they have shot, they never get their target, almost never. Why do they fire so much? Killers are skilled because they only have a few shots. They are paid for this, to kill in a few shots. If I hand you a gun, and I ask you to kill me, even if you are close to me, don't take for granted that you'll get me, because the recoil is so strong that you will probably hit me on the side. You might be able to kill me, but with the recoil fire, they hit on the floor first, and then they can get you. I am happy with the success of the TV series, because it arrived to a world that would have never known those details. We have definitely not glorified anything. I am absolutely certain about this, for one simple reason. There is no character of good criminal, with his own ethics, like Don Vito Corleone. This does not suffice, though, not to create fascination. What we might instill is imitation. But we must be careful here. My style, when I write the script for the series, is to never insert the good. Never. For me, the good side in TV series does not exist. Because I want to tell everything from the point of view of the criminal. Where the state, for instance, is a mere interference in his plotting. I force the audience to enter his logic, while if I offer you a good versus evil opposition, the audience will focus on the conflict, and most certainly your hopes will be with the good. Maybe you can be fascinated by evil, but you support the good. There is no escape. You need to measure pure evil. You must weigh the scum.
Magari ti affascina il male, ma stai col bene. No, non c'è nessuna fuga. Ti devi misurare con i chiavici, non con quella schifezza.
Roberto Saviano on his book Gomorrah and its subsequent film and television adaptations. And that's it for today. Next week, we're at the Institute of Contemporary Arts here in London for the UK premiere of The Exquisite Corpse, followed by a special Q&A with filmmakers Peter Tchaikovsky and Peter Strickland. And we'll catch up with the Portuguese director Marco Martins, the man behind the 2005 film Alice, which won the Director's Fortnight in Cannes. Today's show was edited by Nina Norick and Toby Hammond, and researched by Yolene Goffin. Remember to subscribe to the podcast over at our website. The Cinema Show returns next week. I'm Ben Ryland. Enjoy your weekend.